forward and stay active.
Hear, hear.
Positive.
We have a question here in the back left.
Hello. Thank you guys for being here. I'm in the process right now of getting a producer, and I'm wondering on your tiers, you have an indoor, outdoor. During the building process, if we get the indoor done first, can we add outdoor later, or if I put everything like an indoor, outdoor on the application, do I have to have everything done? Is there somewhere that I could add outdoor later on within that year? Or do I have to have everything done?
So you don't need to have everything done in order for us to issue a license. You would need to have all of the requirements met in the area that you're going to be using. And this is a way that we were trying to be flexible with people right. in this type of situation where maybe you're going to, you're working on the indoor, have the outdoor later.
Or until next year.
Definitely. Right. We do not allow you to change the type of growing that you'd be doing or move up in tiers within your license year. You can do it at renewal. And so what it sounds like you would want to do is actually get a mixed producer license so we could set your canopy size for the indoor and outdoor because there needs to be a ratio between the two.
Right.
And then you could complete the piece that you are ready for. We would license that area, and then you would just need to have us reinspect the other area when you're ready to use it.
Beautiful. Thank you.
I would add that we get that question all the time, too, for growers who intend that maybe in 6 months they're going to be larger. What we usually tell clients is, if you're somewhere between tier one and tier two, which is if you were just indoor or if you're just outdoor, 20,000 square feet is the mark between indoor or tier one and tier two. If you anticipate being anything into the tier two size, 3, 6, 9 months down the road, get yourself to 20,005 square feet legitimately. You have to pretend that you're going to operate it in the sense that you will have to secure it. You do have to have cameras operating and running. But then at least if you're a tier two initially and you are growing at 20,005 square feet, maybe in 3 months you can build a second area or maybe add an indoor. You can't do the indoor facility, but you can add additional mature canopy area. It gives you room to grow within that 12 months. So you figure out where you want to be in 12 months, and if it bumps you up to the tier two, you need to spend, I would recommend spend the extra money, make the planning to get yourself into tier two now, even if you're going to be a tiny tier two grower before you expand, if that makes sense.
Hi, Steve Marchick. I would like to congratulate everybody. And I want to ask, Brent, you mentioned tons of money. Be aware of the tax revenue decrease since October 1st. Our trend is down. That is reality. Secondly, the new testing requirements that was being actually discussed here in Eugene yesterday and up in Portland today, right now, as we're speaking, actually, one of the great things that we have done here in Oregon, all of you included, has been having good, strong testing regulations. Yes, we had a very difficult transition in October. The reality is the lab testing time has been reduced dramatically. Things are flowing through very well. The cost per gram on a controlled situation is 20 cents. If not in control, about $1 a gram.
Russ, do we have a question?
Question, please.
The first part of that I want to answer why we're thinking about it, the reduction in tax revenue. We went from early start into a licensing process, and the absolute reason that tax revenue has gone down is because everybody's happened to get in the licensing process, and many, many licensees, stores mainly, waited to the end to take advantage of every minute of early sales that they could. And so they ran right to the line, and a lot of people got in the mix where they ended up being in the back of the line for licensing at OLCC. So there's some of those stores there. What month are you on right now with stores?
In terms of what?
It's terms of licenses. So as far as if you got an application in by what month?
Right now we're working at the end of January, so we've got about a 3 month backlog.
Okay, so that gives you an idea. So the 3 months backlog, that's all those stores that were able to be online that were medical stores previously through the early start. all got shut off at that deadline, and it just hasn't made it to the point where all the stores will be licensed. So we're going to see those tax revenues go right back up again. It's just a licensing lull that's really causing that issue. So you're going to see a dramatic increase in tax revenue over the next 12 months.
You know, Brent, I think something else you want to point out is under the Early Start program, the tax was at 25%.
Right.
And then in October, the tax changed to a 17% for OLCC licensees with an additional 3% city or county add-on. So the tax is actually lower tax now than it was during Early Start.
Right.
Brent, can I just make a quick announcement? I just wanted to say that our commission about 10 minutes ago adopted our bump up canopy rules.
That is the
avenue in which a recreational grower can grow medically. The rules have some requirements, so please check them out. But we'll get that process rolled out very, very soon.
That's great news. We work really hard with the agency on getting the ability of recreational growers to continue to take care of those patients we've been caring for years. There's several of us in the industry that worked on this. And that is really good news for our medical patients in Oregon, man. One more time for the bump up. Details to come, but ultimately I can tell you it's a great path forward, and it basically allows a rec grower to have a little bit more canopy than a rec grower that would not be caring for patients. So your 40,000 square feet or your 10,000 square feet indoor or whatever you're doing, you're going to get a little bump up to that, and there's percentages around that, and there's a lot of little details. But it basically rewards growers for taking care of sick people, which haven't been paid for doing so for so long. It's going to be refreshing, I think. Do we have any more questions?
We have time for one more question, and I've got it back here. I know a lot of people have questions in the future panels as well to facilitate getting as many questions in as possible.
And
try
to
phrase your question
too.
In the form of a question. Thank you.
My question might round up this announcement, actually. And Brent, you mentioned that the recreational industry currently was essentially built on the backs of patients and patient growers. And Henry this morning... brought up the fact that we all know Monsanto and Philip Morris and Bayer all went in on this.
Right.
So it kind of comes to, we have a bridge here of medical and recreational with 10 minutes ago. But moving forward, when the big corporate capitalists move in for this industry, does the OLCC or the Oregon legislature that anyone's aware of have a game plan to protect small farmers that are either medical or recreational as these people come in?
Great question.
I think that all of those types of things are definitely being discussed. What are the feds going to do, especially with the Trump administration? There's a lot of talk at the legislature and in the governor's office. They're very concerned with what could potentially happen. We've actually had some interesting conversations lately amongst the governors of our western states that are all legal states about potentially creating a states' right agreement that would allow interstate transportation of products. And that's on the table right now. So, and there's a lot of insight to that. So there's a lot of things coming down the pike. No, the answer, I don't think OLCC or anybody is focused on what potentially could happen with legalization if it happened federally. But those are realities. The Philip Morris and those folks are definitely going to be making their way. And but they will, I can tell you that I've seen our governor, who has done a great job of protecting patients and caring about this industry, is going to do everything she can to protect small businesses in Oregon, and I believe that OLCC will take that policy also.
Give it up for our excellent... We got to wrap things up, folks. Give it up for our panel. Danica Hipsman, Amanda Borup, Chelsea Hopkins, Christy Conwell, and, of course, Brent Kenyon. All right, let's get Alex Rogers back up here for you, ladies and gentlemen. Our next panel coming up, going to be a good one.
All right, give it up for these ladies right here. This is amazing. Give it up for women in the cannabis industry. This just happened to be an all-women panel. Not planned. Women are representing in this industry in a big, big way. We just did Berlin. Could all the panel members please walk directly outside the room right now? Thank you so much. Just everybody walk directly outside, and you can be mobbed out there. What was I saying? In Berlin, we did our event in Berlin, and it was shocking because there was no women. I called it a kielbasa strasse. I coined that term, and it's kind of a derivation of sausage factory. But anyway, But it was, but there was about 20-25% women. And all I thought was, man, this, that was like it was back here 10 years ago when you did, like even 5 years ago. And so women have come on so strong in this industry. And now there's, it's not, you don't even notice a discrepancy almost. It's so amazing. So give it up to the female energy coming in this energy, in this industry. All right, our next panel is a real chunky one because it segues perfectly from the last question. What about small farmers? What about small growers? What if you want to stay medical? Where is medical out at right now? We've taken a big hit, there's no doubt. We tried to protect it. The reason I wanted to protect it is because I always said until the recreational laws pair the medical laws, then don't mess with medical, okay? Until recreation, you can have a pound and a half and grow, you know, then don't mess with medical. And I was saying to the people that the Cole memo, a couple years ago when I kind of got into this battle with the Oregon Senate, some of you might remember that or know about that, but basically I was invoking the Cole memo because they were invoking the Cole memo saying, oh, there's too much leakage and medical. I was like, no, everything is locked down, especially since we had the dispensary for medical. The dispensary initiative happened. I was like, the Cole memo, that's for rec. Why don't you guys deal with rec? Because that's the problem. So now with Jeff Sessions or Spicers or whoever comments the other day, you know, it actually just it proves my point that, and I'm not sure what the administration is going to do. We have a few ideas, but and I have some inside information on that. But the point is keeping medical is so important just for liberty because we don't know where this rec thing is. You know, the jury's not out quite yet, okay? So I think it's really important to talk about medical, how this system was all built. Please welcome our next panel and our moderator of our next panel. He's the chief petitioner of Measure 91. It's why cannabis is legal in Oregon. He's our golden boy. Yo, make some noise for Anthony Johnson, everybody. Yo, Anthony Johnson, make some noise! That's why we're here right now.
Thank you very much, Alex. You know, working to legalize cannabis in this industry, in the state, you know, we really have, you know, three main goals. Ending criminal penalties, keeping patients protected and safe access for patients, and helping small Oregon farmers and mom and pops. As far as reducing criminal penalties goes, the state and the citizens, we've done a great job. You know, in 2011, not that long ago, the state of Oregon was arresting and citing more than 1,200 people a month for cannabis offenses. Now, since legalization, that number is down to 20. So that's something we can all be proud of. Not only good for Oregon, but that's something that spreads across the state and actually across the world. Now, as far as protecting patients and small farmers, we got more work to do. And me, myself, other activists, we're not going to stop fighting until patients are all protected and that mom and pops here in Oregon, who have been the foundation of the medical program, which has taken care of patients, were the backbone for legalization, and has really saved the state money by providing medical cannabis to patients that has cut down on prescription drug costs, cut down on the opiate crisis. They're really the foundation. So we got three great panelists who have all been fighting in various realms to help us. We do have a schedule change if you look in your program. Lee Berger is moved to the distribution panel. It's a great honor to introduce.
He's been redistributed.
Yeah, redistributed to the distribution panel. First up, I'd like to introduce Anthony Taylor. I'll introduce everybody on the panel, but Anthony Taylor, Director of Compassion in Oregon, really the leading lobbyist in the state, working to help patients, small farmers all across the state. He was instrumental, really leading the effort to adding post-traumatic stress as a qualifying condition at the legislature. So a round of applause for that, for sure. You know, as far as what the legislature is working and what's working on medical, he's the man that we all really turn to. Sitting next to him, replacing Lee, is Sandy Diesel. Sandy is the director of Right to Grow, another patient advocate organization. I think it's safe to say it's taking the
really the fight really in Southern Oregon, Jackson County, and helping farmers and patients there. And then lastly is Brian Michaels. Brian's a longtime lawyer. I asked him how long he's been practicing law. Of course, he said too long. But more than 20 years protecting patients and people in our industry, and he'll give some good practical advice for us, and then we'll open up to questions. But first up, Mr. Anthony Taylor.
Thank you, everybody, and thank you for being here this this fine Friday morning in beautiful Lane County, the county that I grew up in. And I'm happy to be back. I now live in Yamhill County, where we can grow on EFU lands in the county, and we have no restrictions on OLCC licensing or anything like that, so it's kind of nice, a nice change. We're not fighting like Jackson County or Deschutes County, where the time, place, and manner rules are just about strangling a lot of the businesses, and so we're trying to work on that. Sandy here is working on that in Jackson County. I know there's a big group of people working on it in Deschutes County. Many of my friends are sitting on the panel that advised the county on how to set up the time, place, and manner ordinances. But in the state regulations, in the state law, it says that time, place, and manner cannot be used as a de facto prohibition for these licensing things. So we're all working on that. Right now, the way it is set up, the counties that don't allow OLCC licensing, that affects about 8,000 growers in this state, from the 5,500 growers in Jackson County, some of who can no longer grow on their rural residential property, to the 1,600 growers in Douglas County that can't get an OLCC license, and the 1,800 that are in Marion County, and then all those folks on the eastern side of the state. So we're trying to chip away at that. I know that Representative Helms, a land use specialist on the marijuana committee in Salem, has been trying to push back on that. Took the committee at in the counties, frankly, to task a little bit last week, saying, you know, that we'd work hard on making cannabis a farm use so that it would dovetail with some of these local ordinances, and with their time, place, and manner overreaches, it's really kind of befuddled that whole effort. He's not very happy about it. We're going to ask for one hearing that addresses land use issues specifically. There's two bills before the committee right now that haven't had a hearing yet, but given the, you know, the liberties or the privileges that the joint committees and the revenue and ways and means, those kinds of committees have, they could bring it back before them. It's really an important issue for, you know, a lot of medical growers that just simply can't make the transition, for those that want to, into OLCC, and they're being pushed out of, like, Grants Pass. Aren't they doing something that says you can't grow outside anymore? So it's all these kinds of things that really make it hard for patients. It adds to the cost for their growers, and it's something we're just really working really hard on in Salem to try and remediate. In Salem so far, they've passed out of the marijuana committee and a couple other committees, for that matter, some bills already. One you've probably heard about, which is prohibits the dispensaries and OLCC retail outlets from keeping your personal information for more than 30 days. This was an effort to shield the consumers, customers, and patients from federal intervention. Should federal intervention happen, it kind of gets rid of the paper trail. We've had some significant changes to the Controlled Substance Act in the state of Oregon, rearranging some of the penalties for violation, and I'm sure that Brian Michaels can speak to that better than I can, of course. There were some bills before the Revenue Committee that would have increased the local tax to 8% instead of the 3%. The specific bill on that, which was House Bill 2204, was pulled from its last hearing a couple of weeks ago, but it is in Rules Committee. It could raise its head at any time. I know we all know how hard the legislature is working on, you know, trying to make up for that $1.6 billion shortfall. We don't want them to do it on the backs of the patients. Right now, there's a lot of legislation that came through. There were 30-some bills that addressed marijuana specifically. There were three or four hemp bills, and there were a few bills that were just kind of floating around that weren't in the marijuana committee. They were in judiciary committee, like the social consumption. Actually, social consumption was before the marijuana, but the employment, where the drug screens for a legal substance. You couldn't test for that anymore or prohibit him, couldn't discharge. It was an unfair employment practice. That's kind of died on the vine, even though it was rewritten to apply specifically to patients. We're disappointed that that one didn't get any further than it did. It's really important for patients in the workplace that their ability to perform the job takes precedent over the color of their urine or the content of their urine. So disappointed there. But what remains in front of the committee are two large bills, one Senate Bill 1057, which was introduced through the Rules Committee by the chair of the Marijuana Committee, who also chairs the Rules Committee. And they brought it in after they tried to bring in the merging of the medical with the recreational. That bill came before the committee. The committee chairs were advised there weren't enough votes to support it, so they came back with Senate Bill 1057. Senate Bill 1057 is a brief fix for OLCC to, you know, a mechanical thing. They call it a technical fix bill. It's kind of a housekeeping. But they've got some ugly things in there. They try and restrict the amount of marijuana that a medical that a household can have for medical grows to 6 plants per household, like the 4 plants per household. Doesn't matter how many patients there are, you get 6 plants. They also want to limit the immature plants, and they want to create a database that they have immediate access to so they can verify patient card validities. And then the final thing is their last gasp of merging the two systems, which is bringing everybody under the same reporting system. And that's going to be the seed to sale. I have fought very hard to try and prevent this and let us keep using the OHA system. We spent $1 million on that system. We got half of the people reporting. It just wasn't rolled out very well, not nearly as well as the seed to sale with all the training and all the stuff that went on with OHA like it did with OLCC. So the other bill that's before the committee is one that was originally introduced by Compassionate Oregon. Its original intent was to pull OMMP out of OHA and get some new direction for that program and help save the patients money and lives, you know, and quality of life being raised through their use of therapeutic cannabis. That bill has been toned down mostly just to pull OMMP out of OHA. We've created the Oregon Cannabis Commission to take over those administrative duties. They have rulemaking authority, and they have control over the money. Excuse me, control over the money, which we've never had. And it's, you know, off the backs of the patients, right? So, and then on the tracking system, we've got a softer rollout. OLCC and the co-chairs want to put that in immediately effective in July of 2018. We think that's a little fast. So those are the two remaining big bills remaining before the Legislative Marijuana Regulation Committee, and I think once those two are out, the co-chairs are going to shut that committee down and call it a season. Thank you.
Let's just go down the line and go with Sandy next.
Thank you for having me, and I feel really honored to be sitting on this panel. Anthony Taylor has done tremendous amount of work for decades, and I can't follow that.
You're making me sound really old.
You're very patient and tolerant. I can tell you it's not an easy fight trying to save a medical program. Patients are sick, and so a lot of the problems you heard Anthony talk about and a lot of the problems the businesses that currently exist, whether you're in the medical program or the OLCC side, we've all felt the repercussions of our regulatory system under the threat of the Cole Memorandum, as Alex had talked about earlier. And I think the problems are bigger than what's happened locally in state level. In Jackson County, we've had some real problems. In March of last year, they created regulations that basically said because of Senate Bill 1598 that now deemed, according to their conclusion, cannabis as an agricultural product, and Jackson County's land use code, agricultural products are not allowed to be farmed on rural residential. So that shut out 5,500 farmers in Jackson County. And what that does, it's a domino effect from there. Patients, where are they going to get their medicine? We had a bottleneck in the system with the lab requirements. A lot of the small medical farmers, they're growing for a few handful of patients. And a lot of these farmers are growing specific strains, and they're making specific blends. So they don't have 1,500 pounds to do large-scale batch testing. They might have 1 pound of ACDC or a half a pound of Canisu, and that makes it not a profitable or even affordable or realistic way to stay and continue to help your patients. So there's a lot of problems we need to fix locally and at state level, but I got to tell you, as a patient, where I see the real problem is we got to start focusing on the bigger picture. I feel like these local and state problems we have is a distraction. It's almost an act of war that, it's an art of war, I should say. It's distracting us from the bigger problem. The bigger problem is, I can tell you as a patient that came to a state so I can be in the medical marijuana program, my family lives 2,600 miles away. So for me to visit, I either have to break the law and take my medicine with me or become incapacitated and probably very sick and in the emergency room or worse, back on pharmaceuticals. So it's a problem. It's a problem we need to look at. We need to figure out a way to come together, to unite with organizations such as Compassionate Oregon, to let's not forget about the patients, and to come together and support the people that can be in Salem, or that can find a way. It's really what it's about, is how do we continue to coexist, rec, adult use, medical. We need to coexist, and we need not to forget the patients, because some of these patients are very, very, very sick. They're the oldest and the poorest sometimes amongst us. That's why some of the issues Anthony's been fighting for with the fees and the conditions and the discriminatory system that currently exists. Let's all work together, and let's hook up with Compassion Oregon afterwards and find out how we can support him. By helping the patients, we're helping each other, and we're helping it nationwide. Thanks for having me here today.
Thanks, Amy. All right, next up with some practical advice and sage wisdom, Mr. Brian Michaels.
Hi, I'm Brian Michaels. I'm an attorney here in Eugene, and I'm going to talk to you about more practical things that can happen to you as a medical cardholder that you may not be aware of. But first, I want to touch on the federal issue. First, I want to say the person I go to, for reliable information about what's going on in the legislature, is sitting at the end of the table here. You can go to a lot of people and they can tell you all kinds of things about the state of the law. He's reliable. If he says it, I know it's correct. And that he does so much great work. He's really the champion on this panel here today. But I do want to talk to you about the federal situation, because it came up in the previous panel. And believe it or not, there's some good news. The Ninth Circuit, and we live in the federal Ninth Circuit, so that the Ninth Circuit governs all the federal courts in Oregon, Washington, Hawaii, California, etc. But all the federal courts in Oregon are governed by the Ninth Circuit. And the Ninth Circuit ruled in August that a rider that was put on a budget bill a couple of 3 years ago by a Republican Congress and has been renewed in each budget since then says no money shall be spent to investigate, prosecute, arrest, house any medical marijuana criminal under federal law who's legal under their state. So all the medical marijuana gardens and distribution centers, the feds cannot spend any money to investigate to see if you're illegal federally. And what the Ninth Circuit said was, and they had two cases from California and one from Washington, and they said this rider deprives a federal district court of jurisdiction to even hear a criminal case of somebody who's legal in their state but illegal under the federal law. So a lot of what you fear or discuss or are worried about in terms of federal prosecution regarding medical marijuana possession, production, or distribution, For the time being, you don't have to worry about it. And because it's a legislative act, it supersedes Jeff Sessions, who, as you know, famously said, I used to like the KKK till I learned they smoke pot, which I think is a good thing for two reasons. One, I'm kind of glad the KKK smokes pot. It's probably a good thing. But it also proves something that I've always said. The surveys about the use of marijuana in this country are remarkably low. Every section of society you want to look at, there's going to be a significant, not a majority, but a significant percentage who smoke pot. whether it's cops, whether it's judges, whether it's teachers, whether it's you name it. Everybody smokes pot, even the KKK. And so the optimism I have for the future is good, and it's enhanced by the fact that a majority of states have medical marijuana, which means that this rider is probably going to continue to be renewed until the legislation and the Congress passes legislation to actually put it into law more permanently. I don't think it's going to, you know, he's not going to veto a budget just because of this marijuana rider. And what it does, it deprives Jeff Sessions of doing anything against medical marijuana if it's legal in the state. So there is some good news there. I want to, in terms of a more practical aspect, I want to tell you that every one of you who has a medical marijuana card is vulnerable to getting a driving under the influence charge, even though you're not driving under the influence. And the way it works is this. There's still a strong lobby in Oregon among law enforcement and non-marijuana smoking judges and people of that nature who really want to dispel this whole notion that legalized marijuana is a good thing. And so they have two types of lobbying statistics. One is more kids are smoking. Well, the reason they find that more kids are smoking is they put more cops at high schools. I was on a panel with a cop who had to admit this. Therefore, they catch more people. It's the same number of people smoking, and they're just catching more of them because that's where they're putting their resources now to drum up these statistics. The other statistic, of course, is our roads are unsafe. Look at the increased number of Deweys we have. Colorado was getting some of this, and we're getting a lot of this. And the way it plays is this. I don't know how many of you know what a DRE is. It's a drug recognition exam performed by a drug recognition expert. It's junk science that has been allowed by the Court of Appeals to be admitted as expert testimony. As you know, marijuana stays in your urine for 30 days, at least. So once they find out that you are a medical marijuana card holder, it's a pretty darn good guess there's going to be marijuana in your urine. And so they're just going to, if you have one of these lobbying cops go through the process, they're going to go through the steps to arrest you. And I've seen movies, you know, videos of field sobriety tests of these drivers, and they look perfect, just perfect. They arrest them anyway. They bring them down to the station. And then you got to blow on the breathalyzer to determine if you have any alcohol in it. And then if you don't blow high, most people who smoke pot aren't drinkers, so they're not any alcohol, then they send you to a DRE. And a DRE does a phony exam, and the phony exam is proven only by his or her prediction that there's marijuana in your urine. See? So from the minute you get stopped and they know you have a card, you're going to be arrested for doing under marijuana. Here's how you can stop it. Always blow. Oh, one more thing. You have to pee. I'm sorry. But when you blow lower than intoxicated amount, the Department of Transportation says, if you don't pee, we'll take your license away for a year. They can't use the urine against you in a criminal court unless you do the DRE. So if you can remember this simple mnemonic, which is always blow, always pee, never do a DRE. And there is no consequence for refusing to do a DRE. They don't tell you this. They just start doing it. And when they start taking your pulse, when they start taking your blood pressure and asking you to do funny little things after you've blown into the breathalyzer, that's your DRE. If you can remember to stop them, you don't lose your license. You don't have any consequences whatsoever for refusing to do a DRE. That's the only way you will not be arrested. And the thing is, the reason that you don't have to be under the influence is, in Oregon, if you don't have a Dewey, it's your first Dewey, you can do a diversion. Anybody will take a diversion over trying to win a criminal case. Costs money, uncertainty. So in order to go into diversion, even though you have a great case, I've talked with clients, you look at the video, they're perfectly sober and straight. I had one with a cop when he was demonstrating how to do the heel and toe, slipped and almost fell. My guy did better than he did. honest. But they know that everybody's going to take a diversion. In order to get into a diversion, you have to plead guilty. Click. Another notch to their statistics. This guy, a woman, pled guilty to Dewey. See, we got all these Deweys on the road. Marijuana Deweys. Marijuana is evil. It's making us dangerous. This is a little practical knowledge that you can have, because any one of you is vulnerable to getting a Dewey under marijuana because they know you're a medical marijuana cardholder. Whether you're in the dispensary, whether you're producing, or whether you're a patient. So I give you that advice out of all contexts of this here today, so that maybe you'll walk away and next time one of you is involved in this horrible thing, and I've seen many of these, you'll remember always blow, always pee, never do a DRE. If you can remember that, you won't get arrested and you'll walk home. There's also issues on forfeiture, but I think my time is up. If you have questions about dogs who smell currency and they make like it's marijuana, I'll talk to you about that. But I think my time is up for now. Hopefully I give you something to think about when you get stopped on the road.
Thank you, Brian Michael. To follow up on what Brian said, then I have a follow-up question for Brian. The one good thing about the DRE in the state of Oregon, from my perspective, has been that the Oregon State Police are very proud of the drug recognition exam procedure and think that they are very accurate in their analysis, so that because they're so proud of the DRE, they haven't pushed for a per se THC limit that they have in Washington State, and I think they even passed something similar in Colorado, not as bad as Washington State. So I think that's one good thing, but always remember Brian's advice. And then, Brian, a follow-up question to that, if somebody forgets your sage advice of always blow, always pee, never DRE, and begins to do the, I think it's Lee Berger that coined it, maybe it was you, like the stupid human tricks, right? Stand on one foot, touch your nose. If you start doing the stupid human tricks and you forgot, can you revoke your consent during the middle of the DRE?
I had a case like that once and the judge denied it. And it was the urine test at the end. My client said, okay, I'll do your stupid test, but I'm not going to pee. So they did all the 11-step protocol, the 12th is the urine. And here's the thing about why what Anthony first said, which I believe he believes completely, but the only people who lie more than lawyers are cops, so you got to be careful about believing anything they say. But they actually got a search warrant to catheterize my client, I filed a motion that was completely ridiculous. He's allowed to revoke his consent anytime he wants since DREs are consent. Judge ruled against me. Do I think the judge was wrong? Yeah. But the other reason why the OSP's perspective is misplaced is, a blood test would solve everything. Because it accurately tells you what's in your blood. If it ain't in your blood, it's not influencing your brain. Now, we've all had blood draws. I've said this to juries. Would you rather have a blood draw or would you rather be catheterized? Everyone would rather have a blood draw. And it's more accurate. It tells you whether there's marijuana in your system or not. All the urine does is tell you it was there for the last 30 days. But they choose the least accurate, more invasive method because they don't want the truth. They don't want to know whether or not you're under the influence. They want to arrest you. And they have this junk science urine test system that they could use. And if they were really proud of their DRE exam, they would video and audio them so we could see them and show them to a jury. Never, never. It's all hidden in the dark. And we have to rely on the cops' testimony. The most critical piece of information in a controlled substance Dewey is a DRE, and they won't videotape it. So I don't see any hope soon for that, and I don't think, in my limited experience on this subject, that they'll allow you to revoke your consent, at least for the urine test.
What about for the DRE test, though? If you start to do the DRE test, can you revoke your consent?
My opinion is that it would be a revoke. You're revoking the scope of your consent. But the reality is I've never really had somebody come into my office who did four of the protocols and stopped and didn't do the rest. Once they got you, they got you. They'll keep on you to do these tests and talk you into it. I had the guy who didn't do the urine test with the catheter. It took them almost 2 hours to get him to complete the 11 steps. And they moved on him and moved on him until he did them. So in the abstract, you can stop anytime you want. But once you're started, I think the momentum is against you. I think you really need to just say no from the very beginning. It's your safest way out of this scene.
If I may add, if you refuse to blow the alcohol, you lose your license on the spot.
So
you
for have a year.
To do that for a year. And then the other thing is DRE stands for Drug Recognition Expert and Exam. And you had one of the ways to kind of spark this in your memory is to remember that it stands for Drug Recognition Expert and that the law enforcement person standing in front of you is no drug recognition expert. So just don't go there. Blow, pee, and then
don't do DRE.
Don't do DRE. So.
All right, great advice. Next question for the panel that I have. You know, there 2 years ago, there were 7,000 patients that reported not having a grower. And now that has jumped up to 17,000 patients. Can you shed some light on why that has happened? Kind of how the trend you think will continue and what can we do really to stop that to make sure the patients do have a grower that continues to provide for them?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think one of the best ways to get the growers available for the patients is to have a voluntary registry, because right now that information is guarded from the confidentiality rules in the state and of the registry itself. Your personal medical history, all that stuff is under confidentiality. It's not HIPAA protected. The conversation you have with your doctor about cannabis, that's protected by HIPAA. But once the OHA has your information, that all of that goes away, and they're only bound by the state confidentiality rules. So tell me the question again.
So basically, how do we, do you see the trend continuing?
Oh, yeah.
How do we stop it?
Yeah, so what happened in 2015 is they limited plants. They enacted a very expensive grow site registration fee per patient rather than per address, and they started reporting. And those three things were responsible from taking from January 2015 to October 2016, jacking those numbers, doubling them. They went from 7,000 and change to right now to 17,000 and change. And it's simply because people don't want to report, so they kicked their patients aside and said, we don't want to report, so you'll have to find another grower. And since a lot of people were in I don't want to report mode, they didn't do it. Or the grow site registration fee, which is $200 a patient now, has to be paid by the grower, not the patient. So that, you know, muddled things up too. I expect to see this number continue to grow until we have a voluntary registry list of the growers that are willing to take on more patients. But even that's complicated because some of those people that are growing their 48 plants and they've got 8 patients, when they start, they're allowed to give their cannabis away and have more patients than the requisite 8 to get you to 48 plants. But that starts, if anybody's trying to, you know, eke out some kind of compensation for the compassionate care they're given, that eats into the amount of cannabis that's available for the market. And so that's not happening particularly. And I do expect this trend to continue until we have that voluntary list that patients can find their growers. Because there's lots of people out there right now. Anthony's wife, Sarah, is hooking up patients with growers, but it's getting tougher and tougher, and I don't see that changing really, especially if the legislature gets their way and limits the number of medical grows to a non-designated garden to 6 per household.
You know, what about the potential of medical growers getting access into the OLCC market, particularly those that have been, you know, zoned out by their cities or counties? Any hope for that in the legislature?
There's some hope that's beginning to come up over the horizon. The argument has been for a long time that the medical marijuana patients can't have access to the adult use market because they haven't securityed up. They haven't come into compliance with OLCC licensures. There's one bill, 2198, right now, that brings everybody into metric seed-to-sale tracking, but the trade-off for that, and I, just a quick aside, I don't think metric is going to be that problematic for people growing 36 or 48 plants on the grower side. On the dispensary side, I don't think it's going to be a problem either because they're used to reporting already. So where are we again?
Hope for 2198.
Oh, yeah, 2198. So what 2198 does is the trade-off of bringing everybody into metric is to allow medical marijuana growers to bring 25 pounds a year into the adult use system through the wholesalers and the processors. So that will, not everybody's going to be in there bothering the retail shop owners with, intake and processing. They'll go through the wholesalers. The wholesalers can, leak it out into the system as they do, and then the processors can bring in the leaf and stuff like that for them to process. So if this passes, it means that the 9,000 growers that will be captured in this metric tracking system, because the people growing 12 plants or less are exempt from it under this bill, it'll basically bring about 225,000 pounds into the adult use market that would be going into the black market. So the wholesalers and actually the retailers are really starting to like this because they miss their medical marijuana growers. They miss the relationships they had, and they miss the products and the handcrafted, if you will, products that these growers are bringing in because they have time to take care of two plants that are one specific strain for a patient they're dealing with, and then they have excess. So I think it's a good thing. I think if we all call our marijuana regulation committee and say, support 2198, I think we've got a good chance of getting most of this bill through.
All right. Any questions from the audience? Russ will be around. We got time for a couple
questions.
Get this
guy right back here.
So as we heard earlier, the recreational is going to be able to sell into the medical market, but the medical, that's not true?
Nope, it's not true.
Okay, so then what you're saying here is that we're going to be able to take 25 pounds and put it into the recreational market from the medical side.
If the bill passes as written.
All right, that was just my big concern there, was that if, it was just, you're good.
Got a question here in the back. I'll make my way back there. This is aerobics for me. Thank you. Appreciate it.
I will say that in 1057, Senate Bill 1057, there is a licensing category that the OLCC has created called exclusive medical license. So I'm not quite sure. I think it's kind of a workaround to the federal intervention so people can say, well, we are OLCC, but we're medical only kind of thing. But I'm finding it a little odd since almost all the OHA medical dispensaries have gone to OLCC, and I can't imagine that anybody would, spend $5,000 for the OLCC to open a medical-only license. I just don't think it's going to be used very much. And so, but that's the way legislation is.
We have one way in the back here.
Currently, OLCC will not license a residential grow, so I know a lot of folks who grow medically grow out of the residence. So if we go into OLCC, I can see that being a problem.
Anybody?
Is there any talk going on about that?
Yeah, I believe that the OLCC is not going to license a residence, but if you can have a structure on your property and you're not in a purely residential zoned area, that structure that's not inside your residence can be licensed by the OLCC, but the OLCC does not want to send inspectors into someone's home.
It's a licensed premises, so if you have an existing, say me, I live on my farm, I could have the licensed premises be where the garden area is, and I could still live in my home with my children.
Not if you're in a residence. If you're in a suburban area and you're in a residence,
city
they're
limits?
Not going to Yes, within the city limits. Right now, there's a lot of medical growers within the city limits.
Right. Yeah, unfortunately,
I think what they're trying to express to you in this answer is OLCC's position, which by the way changed. Originally, they didn't exclude residential. Is, and she used the rural grow to make the point. If you have a rural grow, you're not allowed to have any part of that grow operation from seed to sale, as it was, occur in your home. Because OLCC feels that they're not allowed to go into your home. And that's, I think, the point that they were trying to make. They have this notion that you can't waive your right against them entering your home by virtue of your license. I don't know why they want to take that position, but that's their rationale behind taking that position.
Forgive me if this is an ignorant question, but we seem rather organized at this point. Do we have a lobby? And if so, who do we donate to? Also, why aren't we not installing our own people into the government at this point? Because this movement is rather large. We should be a little bit more organized, in my opinion.
Well, I'll give a plug to Compassion Oregon. You could donate to Compassion Oregon. What's the website? Anthony?
CompassionateOregon.org. Oh, and the lobby's right out there, by the way.
and as far as running for office, I think more people from the community do need to run, and the community needs to support people from within our community. But, you know, it's just a sausage-making factory that a lot of people don't want to put themselves and their families through.
Yeah, it can get ugly in a hurry. And the county commissioner races are tough to win, but the local city races are not that hard to win, and they don't take that much money. And typically, the city councils are somewhat evenly divided, so if you can oust one of the anti-votes, you can almost always sway the council. You become the majority, so... All politics is local.
And to answer your question about coming together, that's a great blood enthusiasm. We really need that to happen. And what we found in the industry is, for a lot of parties, we're constantly reacting. We're constantly trying to jump through hoops to figure out how do we comply, how do we keep up with the regulations, what do we do next. So why folks don't come together is a lot of times we're just really trying to survive. And we're still trying to figure it out. I can say for our organization, we haven't figured out how to put the right government, right bodies in the government seats, but we have figured out how to get them out of office, as we did in Jackson County to our lovely commissioner. So that is the next step. So the fellow in the back, come find us, and let's unite, and let's work on this as a statewide initiative and not just at the local level.
But Sandy has started an initiative in Jackson County to try and turn some of this around. That's also a good idea locally, because the state level, you need 68,000. How many do we need now? How many?
It's like 88,000 ballots.
88,000. That's way more than six. You know, 88 is larger than six. So, you know, it's a lot of times it's like 100 signatures to get the local council to write up the ballot title, and then you go collect signatures, and it gets put on the ballot. And the way we're going to do this is little by little at the local level, chipping away at their walls and making sure that they don't have these kind of, you know, de facto bans.
A question back here.
So I'm a small-time business owner. I'm just starting up, and my company is Edible Gummies. And they're in the shape of rubber duckies. And I was actually wondering why and if they would be allowed to be sold. And why aren't they being allowed? Like, shapes, the only way a child would actually see them if an adult takes them out of the black or silver package and shows them to the kid. So I don't think it should actually be taken away or controlled on that point.
Yeah, the shape of gummies, appealing to kids.
Yeah, unfortunately, the state regulators have taken very strict stance on what may appeal to children. I do not believe duck-shaped gummy bears are allowed.
Nope, can't even have a picture of them on the package.
Yep.
Anything that can be construed as in the children's realm, for instance, the strain name Girl Scout Cookies, can't use it. Not in Oregon.
So you make the gummies in like the shape of like math homework or like household chores some way that I don't apply to children.
Yeah, biology experiment. We're really fortunate in Oregon to have such a wide variety of people that are interested in this issue and bringing their, you know, thoughts and comments to bear on the people that are writing the rules. And it's had an effect. Originally they were going to say that, you know, if you're making cookies, you have to have this certified commercial kitchen and all that sort of stuff. And then we said, well, what about sharing kitchens? And they go, okay, that sounds good. And then they brought back language that absolutely prohibited it. And we said, well, we had this conversation. And I said, yes, we did, but it's kind of hard to work it out. Well, work it out, you know. And so we've been able to bring pressure on these folks. And I got to tell you, if we have managed to allow this cannabis coming into the adult use from the medical people, that's going to be huge. It's really going to change the dynamics of how cannabis is regulated in this state. And through this conversation, because a lot of the licensees say, well, these people didn't spend the tens of thousands of dollars on all this compliance that we did. Well, maybe that speaks to the point that maybe that wasn't all necessary. And if over the next couple of years these people bringing their stuff in from the medical market proves us out and not them out, then maybe we have that conversation about maybe we don't need so many cameras or a 10-foot fence or, you know, whatever it might be. So it's an evolving situation, and I think we're going to come out on the better end of it in the next couple of 3 years as things start to settle out. That's one thing about the urge to merge. One of the main arguments against it was, God, we're in rural, we're fatigued with writing rules, not just us, but the agencies themselves. They've been writing rules constantly for the last 2 years since 91 passed, and they've had to make it work. And they've rolled back dates. They've rolled back testing dates and labeling dates and all that sort of stuff. So sometimes when we're talking about dates in legislation, you know, it's maybe not a battle you want to fight, because it's going to be obvious in 6 months that that date needs to be moved, and the agencies will take the appropriate steps to do an emergency rule and move that date back. So keep it up out there. Keep pushing back against them, because that's how we make our views heard and we affect change.
Let's just do one more question, Russ. We're running long here.
I was just going to try.
Yeah, I just want to comment on what I think is the importance of 2198, and thank you, Anthony, for working on it. And to the question, how do we help? This man has been lobbying for medical marijuana and to save the patients and doing it almost unpaid, and we all need to help him out. We should have a lot more influence in Salem. If you go and watch the last hearing that happened Tuesday on the internet, what you'll see is the legislators listening a lot to the police and listening a lot to the people that want rules that don't really do anything but spend a lot of money. And it's kind of all coming to a head right now with whether we're going to pass 2198 and allow medical growers into the system or not, whether we're going to have a closed system with, instead of 35,000 farmers, you know, 350, or maybe it'll work up to 1,000. But I think that'll be a terrible result if that happens. And the way we get out of that is to pass 2198. And the other part of it is, you know, I believe in medical marijuana. And I don't like the idea of tracking all these marijuana plants, but not tracking how medical marijuana is working. We have 10,000 people in Oregon right now using marijuana to treat their cancer, and nobody's even taking notes on the result. And we have let that happen by letting the police have the power and influence in Salem and not doing it ourselves. And so I say to you, all of you, we need to pass 2198. We need to support Anthony Taylor and Floyd Prezansky and my senator that have been working on this. And so my question is, what can all of us do to make sure 2198 passes? Because it's very important. And then I also want to say to you that if we don't pass this, a lot of us are talking about going back and doing another initiative to reboot this initiative so we don't have to suffer from all this overregulation, that we can have a system that is free, and we can have a system that recognizes marijuana as medicine and not just money. So how do we pass 2198? Let's get this done.
First of all, give it up for John Sajo, who's been working in this as long as anybody, speaks with authority.
Well, I want to, you know, take a minute to thank John. I've known John for, 35 years or something like that now? And that man has been growing marijuana all this time and never once got arrested for it.
Yeah.
So So that's either some kind of record or a DEA plant. I'm pretty sure it's some kind of record. So, but to speak to 2198 and how we get it passed, I know right now that Senator Prezansky, Senator Cruz, John's senator, Carl Wilson from the Grants Pass area, and now Ken Helm, who is the land use guy, have all united behind 2198, and they've been having ongoing meetings since Tuesday with the governor's office and Rob Bobet and the OLCC, and we just have to keep calling those people and say we really support 2198. Right now we've gotten a number of the stakeholders to testify in favor of it. I think we're going to see the retailers, because they love that stuff coming in, and the process or the wholesalers coming on board with this bill too. So let's make some phone calls Monday and Tuesday and just tell them we want 2198 as amended. And just keep calling, keep sending emails. Keep them brief. Don't rant. Don't show your anger. Just say, you know what? We just really think this is a good way through what we're all struggling with right now, which is 80% of all the marijuana produced in this state outside the regulated system. And that's not good. You want sessions in this state? That's how you do it. So let's call our representative, call the people on that committee and say, support 2198. I will tell you, for the record, that we're one vote away from it. So call those co-chairs, specifically those co-chairs. Call Senator Ferrioli. Call Representative Fahey, who is from the Junction City, Cheshire area out there. Call them. They're all on the committee. Say, we need this bill. This is what's going to save our state from federal intervention.
Yes. Call 2198. Give it up for our panel, everybody. Anthony Taylor, Sandy Diesel, Brian Michael. Let's hear it. Yes. They'll be available to speak to you outside, I'm sure. And let's give the podium back to the wonderful Anthony Johnson, everyone. Okay. Anthony Johnson.
This panel. Thank you. All right. We've gone through OLCC regulations. We've gone keeping it medical. And if you're in the industry, you need to have a good distribution model. So next up is the cannabis distribution panel. I have the pleasure of introducing the moderator. She's been a pioneer in this industry, helping patients, been a successful businesswoman as well. And she is the owner of Karen Sprague Essentials and Consulting. So please give a warm welcome to our moderator of the cannabis distribution panel, Ms. Karen Sprague.